Nice to be here again. I haven't been here for quite a while, actually, quite a few years now. It's very nice to be here again. And I have just come from Bangkok. We just landed at Changi Airport about, 8 o'clock. Came straight here, so it's kind of, really, no messing around, right? Just getting on with business and things. That's actually very good. So today is New Year's Eve, so ideally what we should do, we should really keep going until midnight, right? That's what we should do. So are you ready for that? What do you want to do? Because actually that's what we do in Perth. In Perth at the Dhammaloka Center in the city, Ajahn Brahm always has a New Year's party, right? And the New Year's party is like they have a little bit of games, they have a bit of chanting, a bit of meditation, a bit of Dhamma talk, everything kind of combined together. A bit of fun and also a bit of serious Dhamma, which is kind of trademark Ajahn Brahm, right? Fun and Dhamma combined, which is really good. So it's actually very nice to be able to come to a Buddhist center on the New Year's Eve, because most people on New Year's Eve, they go out drinking and they do all kinds of stupid stuff. So it's wonderful to have a community like this, a place where you can go and you can actually do something wholesome rather than doing all the stupid stuff that people normally do on New Year's Eve. It's great, right? This is what the idea of Kalyanamitta is all about. It's about being able to have friends and having people who can actually work with you and can practice with you and then can kind of pull you along in the same direction, which is great. So I'm going to try to speak kind of clearly tonight, but my mind is a little bit kind of all over the place right now because it came straight from the retreat in Bangkok, just one thing after the other. But we'll see what comes out of this anyway. The topic for tonight's talk is about commitment and perseverance. This is actually, I think, one of those very important basic things in Buddhism. How do we really commit and how do we perceive in the practice? And the reason why it is so important is because if you want results in your Buddhist practice, if you want this thing to work, it is something that you have to do over the years, over the decades, sometimes over the lifetimes, right? And this is how you actually eventually move towards the Buddhist goal, getting rid of suffering and experiencing some real happiness in life. So this idea of commitment and perseverance is kind of very crucial. And often when people think about the Buddhist teachings, they think that Buddhism is the hard part of Buddhism is to understand the teachings, right? To think about them, to reflect. What does dependent origination mean, right? And the kind of classical English gentleman sitting back in his armchair, smoking his pipe, right? With his glass of sherry, perhaps contemplating dependent origination. Avijja, paccaya, sankhara. Okay, very interesting. What might this mean? And this is kind of the intellectual Buddhist, right? The thinker. And people often think that Buddhism is a very complicated religion with many kind of profound teachings. So you need to do a lot of contemplation and thinking and reflection about these teachings. But one of the interesting things is that about the Buddhist teachings is that it is not really a philosophy at all. People think that Buddhism is like a philosophy. It is something which perhaps has been worked out, right? But the Buddha was very clever, very smart, so he worked out this philosophical system. But one of the things that you find in the suttas, one of the things that the Buddha says very clearly is that when I teach, the teachings I give you compared to what I actually know about the world is similar to this handful of leaves that I've picked up compared to all the leaves in the Gosinga grove. It's one of the grove which is just there. Right? So the point is, and this is kind of the crucial aspect of these Buddhist teachings, they are pragmatic, they are practical, they are about how to get from this point is suffering, right? And how to move over here somewhere, which is kind of hopefully a bit more happiness over there. So this is what it means, very pragmatic. There's no time to waste on philosophizing, on thinking about how the world works, physics, that kind of stuff. It's kind of irrelevant, right? Get down to the mental aspect, the things that actually make a difference, that those things that actually kind of move us forward in this life. This is so important. And if you look at Buddhist history, it's very interesting to see how that has been sidetracked throughout Buddhist history. after the Buddha passed away, one of the first things all the monks and the nuns, perhaps the lay people too, started to do after the Buddha passed away was to start philosophizing straight away, right? They looked at these teachings and said, oh yeah, there are a few holes here, a few things missing. We've got to figure it all out, right? What actually belongs in these holes? We've got to have a complete system. And that, of course, that idea of filling in all the gaps that the Buddha left behind, that was the origin in a large part to the Abhidhamma system. The Abhidhamma was worked out maybe 100 years, up to 300 years after the Buddha, gradually expanded. And that, the Abhidhamma, is precisely a philosophical system. It's about working out all the details, right? Figuring out all the various elements in the world. If you read the Abhidhamma, it talks about the different types of mind states, the different types of experiences you can have. It talks about mind moments, how short they are, how long they are, how many they are, right? In a second, how many mind moments there are in a second, right? That kind of stuff. So it's about dividing up the world, constructing a philosophy, a theory about what the world is like. And it's fascinating, isn't it, how we as human beings, we tend to do that sort of stuff. A part of that, I think, is because we are just restless, right? Our mind is always thinking. Right, you just had a meditation before, right? How many people had no problems at all with thinking during the meditation? How many? Right? This is the problem, right? We are very restless by nature. And that restlessness often then moves us into speculating about things, thinking about things. And of course, if you can work out a system like the Abhidhamma, which hopefully is based on the Dhamma to a certain extent, it's also very satisfying. Especially, it is satisfying to the sense of self, right? Wow, I did this, right? Look at this. Look at this beautiful system. It all fits together very nicely. And also, it fits together with how the Buddha taught and all of these kind of things. So you can see how easy it is to get sidetracked and how we always have to kind of pull back in a sense. Get back to the essence of things, the core of things, the things that really matter. The hard part in Buddhism is not the philosophizing. The hard part in Buddhism is not all the studying and all the understanding of dependent origination, all that kind of stuff. That is not the hard part at all. It's actually easy to understand Buddhism. What you have to do is very straightforward. You don't really even have to worry too much about dependent origination. You can, because dependent origination, as far as I'm concerned, is a very beautiful teaching. It actually may surprise you, also quite practical if you understand how it works. But you don't really have to worry about those things. There are more important and basic qualities in Buddhism that come way before these kind of things. So that is one side where people tend to hang out, on the intellectual side, right? I'm sure there are some intellectual Buddhists here. I used to be a bit like an intellectual Buddhist myself. Sometimes I still get trapped in that kind of, you know, that kind of bypass which kind of leads nowhere. This is just how things tend to be. And of course, the other side, which doesn't get you anywhere, which also is not really what Buddhism is about, and which also can sometimes be what people think they should be doing, and that is all the rituals, right? Buddhism is absolutely rife with rituals. As you travel around the world, go to any country, go to Sri Lanka. I usually go to Sri Lanka once a year, which is a wonderful place to go. It's a very beautiful country with lots of beautiful jungle and very, very nice. Right, Upal? Sri Lanka is nice. Upal, are you with me? Yeah? It's beautiful, right? Lots of nice forests, lots of nice monasteries, beautiful mountains, and very nice. And what I think is really cool about Sri Lanka, this is my favorite thing about Sri Lanka, everybody is interested in the suttas, right? Everybody wants to understand the Dhamma from the suttas. And this is one of those very beautiful things about Sri Lanka. So when I read the sutta, all I have to do is read the word of the Buddha, make a few comments, and you say, sadhu, sadhu, what a wonderful teaching. Right? It's so very easy to be a teacher in Sri Lanka. Very, very nice. So, but still, the majority of people in Sri Lanka, probably also like the majority of Buddhists here in Singapore, in Thailand, in Burma, in China, everywhere basically where there are lots of Buddhists, a large number of rituals, right? In Sri Lanka, they chant all night, right, to make merit, that sort of thing. and all of these kind of things that we do. But again, that's kind of, it's a side issue, right? That is not really what the practice is about. I'm not saying that all rituals are bad. Sometimes rituals can be okay, but you have to use them in the framework of the teaching in such a way that they have some kind of meaning. If they have no meaning, if they don't kind of fit in with the rest of the teachings, they're not all that useful. So these are, to me, in one way of looking at the two extremes, if you like, of Buddhism: intellectual Buddhism, ritual Buddhism. And we want to find the middle way. And that middle way, that is actually the hardest one. Thinking about things is easy. It's our habit. Rituals is also easy because it's our habit to have a lot of faith and kind of show our faith through rituals. The hard one is actually to develop yourself, to change yourself, to move, to go somewhere in this world where you haven't been before, to improve your happiness and reduce your suffering and also help the people around you. This is the hard part. And the reason why it is so hard is because it is very difficult, especially in lay life, also in monastic life sometimes, to commit yourself to those teachings 100%. And then when you are committed, to persevere in the practice as well. Right? This to me is the hardest part of Buddhism: commitment and perseverance. Right? It sounds so kind of, you know, there's nothing to it, right? Commitment, perseverance, but actually this is where it is really hard. So the question is then, if this is so hard, what can we do to gain that commitment? What can we do to ensure that we persevere in such a way that this path actually does give real results? If you have been on this path for a short while, sometimes you wonder, is it giving results or not? What's happening? Is it really working for me here? Right? And it's so important that it should give results. Otherwise, we're wasting our time being Buddhists. So the way to do this, the way to understand how to give rise to this commitment and perseverance, is to have a little bit of a look at the structure of the Buddhist path, the Buddhist way of awakening here. And one of the very nice suttas, right, you're going to hear this word suttas a lot when you hear from me, one of these nice discourses is a discourse which is found in the Anguttara Nikaya. And this is a discourse which shows causality, the causality of how the end of the path, awakening, right, liberation, how that actually comes about. And this is one of those great things about Buddhism. It is all about causality, all about conditioning, how one thing leads to the next one. And the reason why Buddhism is all about that is because once you take the sense of a permanent self out of the equation, then everything is causality. Everything is conditioned. Everything exists in relation to other things. Nothing has any independent independence. Right? That's kind of the nature of non-self. If you have a self, that's kind of outside because it's permanent, it's stable. If there is no self, everything is relational. So this sutta, it talks about this relationship, what actually it is that leads you to awakening. Right, to liberation, to happiness, to the end of the defilements. Interesting, right? How do we get there? Pretty core, pretty kind of essential part of Buddhism. So what is it? It traces it back, stage by stage, one condition being before the previous one, all the back, till you get back to the first condition. So let me just give you those conditions very briefly, because it's quite an interesting series, actually. I'm not going to discuss this in detail, because then we won't even make it for midnight, right? We'll be here tomorrow. Are you off work tomorrow morning? No work. Okay, good. So we can go a long way then. Okay, great. So what we can do, we can have a nap in the middle, and we can continue afterwards. There's a very famous story about this. Ajahn Brahm tells this story. This is a story of a monk. I'm just kind of sidetracking a bit, but I hope you don't mind. This was a monk who was a teacher in Thailand. Ajahn Brahm was there listening to this talk. He was a Thai monk. And sometimes these monks are really chilled, right? Really, really relaxed. And they just sit there and they talk about all kinds of things. Sometimes it's nice, sometimes it's not so interesting. And he was getting really tired, right? He's giving the talk, right? And then in the middle of his talk, he falls asleep. Imagine falling asleep while you're giving a talk. That is A+ for being relaxed, right? So I'm really, he's kind of my hero in terms of relaxation for giving Dhamma talk. Yeah. And then in Thailand, your relationship to the teacher is very, very formal. So as long as he's sitting there, you can't walk out, right? So he's sitting there snoring away on the chair. And then after 15 minutes, oops, oh, what's going on? He kind of wakes up again. And then he continues the talk exactly where he left off, right? So this is really, really nice. I really like that story because it's hard to imagine how you can fall asleep while giving a talk. But anyway, so let's get back to the main issue. So awakening. Maybe he was so awakened that he was absolutely relaxed. I'm not sure. So what is the initial cause for awakening? And I'm sure you will probably know this already. What is the cause, according to this sutta, is the seven factors of awakening, the Bhojangas. I'm sure many of you will have heard of those. Are there many new people here today who haven't come here before? Many new ones? One over there? Okay. So, okay. So probably when I say all of these words, it's kind of completely blank for you, right? What is he talking about? Right? Okay. So just that it's not actually difficult. It's just that the terminology sometimes is a bit different. That's all. So the seven Bhojanga. Bhojanga means factor of awakening here. So these are the qualities in the mind that are required for awakening to occur here. Right? And those Bhojangas, they are basically about samadhi practice. When you look at them carefully, you see how they're used in the suttas, they're all about samadhi. And this fits with the overall picture in the suttas, that samadhi is the basic cause that you require for awakening to be possible. So, fair enough. Okay, so what is the cause for that samadhi? The cause for that is the satipatthana, the foundations of mindfulness, or the focuses of mindfulness, or the the different way of translating that word. And the reason for that is because the foundations of mindfulness essentially is about watching the breath and that kind of thing. So it's really about meditation practice that takes you towards samadhi. You can see why that is the case. Right, then the question, what is the cause and the condition for satipatthana to be possible? And I hope I get my factors right. I'd be very embarrassed if I get them all wrong. And then you can get all these emails afterwards. You're a terrible teacher. What are you telling us? So the cause for that is the three types of good conduct. Body, speech, and mind, right? In Buddhism, three kinds of good conduct. All meditation, this is actually a very interesting one, an important one. All meditative success is based on the three kinds of good conduct. Right? In other words, if you haven't got that together yet, if you haven't purified that to a certain stage, you're not going to have success in your meditation practice. Right? And this is, I think, is such a crucial issue. It is something which often isn't understood in the Buddhist world, especially when they take the Buddhist teachings out of, take certain aspects of the Buddhist teachings, pulls it out of its framework, and then start to use it in a secular context. This is happening particularly in the Western world because Westerners have no clue about Buddhism, right? So, oh yeah, I like the meditation part, don't like the other stuff, so I'll take the meditation part. Thank you very much. And of course, it doesn't work anymore. If you take it out of its framework, if you don't understand how this overall system works, there is no way you're going to have success, right? This falls apart. And this is the pillar upon which meditation is based, is good conduct, three kinds of good conduct. Very important. I will get back to this later on because this is kind of going to be one of the core issues that I want to talk about. So then the question is, what is the condition that give rise to three kinds of good conduct? And the sutta says sense restraint. And sense restraint basically means to have a fairly even mind during the day, not to allow yourself to be pulled around by the defilements, right? Anger coming here, powerful desires coming over there, but have this kind of even mind, which is sitting there in the middle, and you flow through the day with a certain amount of mindfulness. You can see what you do, you can see how you live, and you can react in an appropriate way to the things around you. Sense restraint is actually all about wisdom. When you say restraint, it sounds like force, But actually, sense restraint is really about wisdom. This is one of the things I always make a point of when I teach meditation retreats, is to understand that sense restraint is about wisdom power rather than willpower. And this is very clear from the suttas. For those of you who are new, sutta is a discourse by the Buddha, right? Sutta, very important word. So the first Pali word to learn today if you are new to this. Sense restraint. What is the cause for sense restraint? And this sutta says that clear comprehension. Clear comprehension is about having clarity roughly about how to live your life. What things are supportive for the Buddhist practice, what things are not supportive, and then move towards those things that are more supportive, right? Don't spend too much time at the casino, you know, that kind of stuff. So minimize your casino time and other things that are kind of unwholesome, you minimize that. Right? So you do things that are roughly in line with the Buddhist teachings. And then that is what clear comprehension. I'm not going to go into detail about that because it's a bit technical. What is the cause for clear comprehension? Yoniso manasikara. Wise attention, right? Is actually the cause here for clear comprehension. And this is one of these very critical terms on the Buddhist path, yoniso manasikara. It basically means how you attend to things in the world, right? So if I look at one of you, right, and I think, oh, I really, really, really don't like this person, right? Or I like this person, not sure. And once you have that sense that you don't like somebody or you like somebody, and that leads to desire or anger, that is called ayoniso manasikara, unwise attention, because you are allowing the defilements in the mind to arise. So this is the problem here, right? So the yoniso manasikara is all about looking at the world in such a way that it actually helps you on the path and it moves you in the right direction. That's quite literally how it is defined in the suttas. And this is something that you have to take with you from the very beginning, right? If you start off on the Buddhist path, and when you start off on the path, you hear the Buddha's teachings, you think, yeah, that's terrible stuff, don't like that at all, right? That would, from the Buddhist point of view, that's ayoniso manasikara, unwise attention. But if you hear the Buddhist teachings and you think, yeah, there's something to this, there's something powerful going on there, I think this will lead to happiness if I practice these teachings, right? If you have that kind of attitude and it lifts your mind up and it moves you in the right direction, that is what yoniso manasikara is all about. So whenever that perception is such, whenever the thinking mind is such, that you can see that you are kind of heading in the right way, yoniso manasikara, wise attention. What does wise attention come from? Wise attention comes from faith. It comes from confidence and conviction, right? You have heard the Buddha's teachings and you think, wow, this is so good, right? This is powerful. So you listen to the Buddha. The Buddha says, think like this, don't think like that. And you say, yes, sir. And and that's what you try to do. Straight away, it doesn't work, right? It takes a long time to turn the mind around. But gradually, you're able to follow those instructions of the Buddha. So faith and confidence is what actually initially gives rise to wise attention. After a while, this becomes like your own wisdom, right? After a while, you kind of take it on board. You see how it works, and it actually becomes your own wisdom. But initially, it comes from faith and confidence in the teachings of the Buddha, which is kind of interesting, because not really what you expect when you think about wise attention. You think it's something internal, I am being wise. But initially, it has to come from the outside. And this is actually, again, one of those crucial things about this path to understand, that it always comes from the outside, first of all. Then, where does that faith come from? The faith, confidence, comes from hearing the true Dhamma, the Saddhamma. Saddhamma means the true Dhamma or the good Dhamma in Buddhism. So it arises from that, right? When you hear the teachings of the Buddha, then one person is leaving. Had enough already? Is that right? No? Okay, no. I'm just joking. I'm just messing around. Sometimes I give talk, you see people leaving, think, gee, what have I said, right? Whoa. Scary. So when you hear the real teaching of the Buddha, the Buddha's word, for those people who are ready, for those people who haven't got too much dust in their eyes. You know that expression, dust in their eyes? Yeah, right, too much dust in your eyes, oh, can't see anything. But only have a little bit of dust in your eyes, you can actually see what is going on. So when you hear that true Dhamma, and I think many people have this experience, wherever you are in the world, there's something very powerful about it. You hear these teachings and you think, gee, this is it, you know, this is what I've been looking for all my life. This is where I want to go, this is what I want to do, this is what life is about. This is the answer to the actual meaning of life itself. This was my experience when I came across these teachings. I started to look into them. I understood, jeepers, this actually is the answer to the meaning of life. How can I not commit myself? If I don't commit myself, I'm crazy. Of course I have to commit myself to this. And I'm still committed after 20 years as a monk, right? So it obviously has worked reasonably well here. So where does that listening to the true Dhamma come from? And that comes from hanging out or to seeing the Sapurisa. Sapurisa means like the superior people, right? Superior people, the good people, whatever you want to call it. And these superior people, these are like the Aryas in the world. Arya means like the noble ones, those who have a direct insight into the teachings of the Buddha. These are the Aryas. Who is the number one Arya in the world? The Buddha, right? Not Ajahn Brahm, the Buddha. Sometimes people think, oh, yeah, no. So, and this is a very important point, that it actually is the Buddha. Because the vast majority of Buddhists in the world, they have faith in this master here. They have faith in this Rinpoche here. They have faith in this Bante. They have faith in this Ajahn, in this Sayado, in this Ayah, right? This is how we are. We tend to want to see the living examples in the world. And it's more abstract and more difficult to have faith in the Buddha himself. But actually, when you think about it, there is always a degree of uncertainty about all these monastics and lay people who teach the Dhamma. You don't really know that well, right? Are they really enlightened? Have they got any insight? Do they know what they're talking about? And there's only one person at the end of the day that you have to have faith in, and that is the Buddha. Why? Because if the Buddha wasn't there, the whole Buddhism would fall apart. He is the foundation upon which everybody else builds further. And if that foundation work is not there, if that collapses, if you take it away, everything else disappears like a house of cards. Bang, it's gone. So for this reason, when you're talking about the superior people, when we're talking about the Kalyanamitta, is the Buddha is the most important one. And that is why I have always myself found it so powerful to actually read the suttas of the Buddha. It's amazing that we still have the word of the Buddha after 2,500 years, right? We still have it to a large extent. And there are very good grounds for thinking that we have them after 2,500 years. And when you investigate them, they are like the gold standard by which all other teachings should be measured. Right? I'm not saying that you should not listen to anybody else, right? Otherwise, what on earth am I doing here, right? I should get out of here straight away. So I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is just that sometimes it is great to go back to the original word, to the foundation upon which everything else is built, and see what the Buddha has to say about things. And often that can clear away doubts, clear away uncertainties about things, and things start to become much more clear for you as a consequence. So this is the first step, right? The very first step on this path is actually seeing the noble people, seeing the Aryas. That is where everything starts out from. And this is a very interesting statement that has many, many consequences for how we should live our Buddhist life. First of all, you may wonder, how can this be the case? How can this be the kind of foundational step? How can everything come from there? And to understand that, you have to go to one of the other teachings of the Buddha, a very famous teaching that many of you will have heard about. And this is the teaching where Venerable Ananda, who is the number one chief disciple, not chief disciple, he's the number one attendant to the Buddha, and he goes to the Buddha and he says, Venerable Sir, this idea of Kalyanamitta, of good friendship, is half of the spiritual life. right? And you, when I think that, I think, yeah, that kind of makes sense, right? It's very important to have good spiritual friends. So maybe 50% is about right. Because you have to, after all, you have to be virtuous. You have to do all this other kind of stuff, right? And then the Buddha says to him, no, Ananda, that is not so. Please watch what you're saying. Kalyanamitta, good friendship, is 100%. It's the whole of the spiritual life. Right? Now you can start to see why that foundation stone at the beginning, why that stone has to be in place. And seeing the Buddha, hearing the true Dhamma, and only then does everything else arise. If it is 100%, of course, that foundation has to be there. Otherwise, nothing is going to come out of it. So how do we understand this? And this is where this is actually very hard to really appreciate 100%. But this all comes from the Buddhist idea of non-self. Right? As I was saying before, if there is no self, if there is nothing that is permanent in this world, nothing that is stable, nothing which is always there, if that is true, if that is correct, means everything is conditioned. It means that each one of us, we are just the sum total of the causes, the conditions, and the circumstances that are working on us. Right? That's what it means. And if you are the sum total of the cause and conditions that are working on you, it means that you are like a ship on the ocean. A ship on the ocean that has no rudder, it has no oars, it has no steering mechanism, it has no sails, it has no engine, right? All of that is gone. The paparazzi has arrived. Okay, so all of these things. And because of that, that ship itself is completely vulnerable to the circumstances around it. If the wind comes from the north, the ship drifts to the south, right? If the current comes from the east, the ship goes to the west. It is 100% dependent on the circumstances around it. And we are like that ship on the ocean. We drift according to the currents of the world, right? And this is one of the results of the fact that there is no self, or the Buddhist idea that there is no self. It is very hard to see this. And the reason why it is so hard to see is that it feels like there is a self. It feels like we are in charge. It feels like we're making decisions all the time. It feels like we are reflecting wisely. You're only sitting back in your chair and you're musing about dependent arising and drinking your cognac. It feels like you're doing something important, right? And that's actually interesting. The English word musing, do you know the English word muse, to muse? It's one of these really old-fashioned words that was used maybe back in the 19th century or something. And it basically means like to think and to reflect and to contemplate. That's what it means. So you're musing about things, contemplating things. And the early Buddhist translators, they didn't know much about Buddhism. I'm talking about the Westerners now, kind of. They were just starting out, getting all this Pali text. Whoa, thousands and thousands of pages of Pali text. Nobody knew what was going on. And so they started translating it. And of course, when you translate without any spiritual input, without any personal experience of what is going on, you're bound to make massive, really big mistakes. So one of the mistakes they did was they translated jhana, the powerful states of samadhi. That was translated as musing, right? Thinking, you know, oh, smoking your pipe. Right? So you can see how problematic it gets when you have no spiritual input and you try to translate such powerful spiritual teachings. Basically, you're out of your depth. You have no idea what's going on. It's very, very problematic. So that's just a highly aside from what I'm talking about. So again, it's this thing that we are conditioned by the circumstances out, and it's hard to grasp how conditioned we are. It's very difficult to fully understand that. The only way you can really see that is by penetrating this yourself, seeing it for yourself. Only then can you really understand this fully. In the meantime, we just have to go to some extent on faith and confidence. Buddhism also has faith and confidence, not just an idea in theistic religions. In Buddhism too, we have to have these things. You recognize some of the truth, and then you go further based on the faith and confidence that you have. So this is why the Kalyanamitta is so important, right? Because if we are 100% dependent on the circumstances around us. If that Kalyanamitta doesn't come, if the person who doesn't get you started on the Buddhist path doesn't arise and tell you what's going on, you will just drift randomly in this world according to all other kind of things. You need that that stability, that Buddhist input to be able to drive you in the right direction. Right? This is really what this means. But there's a kind of this very interesting corollary or something which kind of comes out of this, which is very fascinating as well. And basically, if we are entirely conditioned, it means that we are brainwashed. Right? That's what it means. So when you come to the Buddhist center here, what you should do, you should sit down, you should listen to the talk, especially if it is of the word of the Buddha, and you should allow yourself to be brainwashed. Right? This is why you come here. You come here specifically to be brainwashed. Right? Don't tell that to your family or to anyone else. They might think, oh, get them out of that very quickly before they, you know. Because that was, I remember when I became a monastic first, right? My family is obviously not Buddhist. Well, not, actually, not obviously, but they are not Buddhist. And they were very concerned. I said, I want you to go to a Buddhist monastery and perhaps ordain. And the first thing they said, oh, you will just get brainwashed, right? Buddhism. They didn't know anything about Buddhism. They thought this was a really weird kind of Asian religion that was really dangerous, right? They probably read a bit about Hare Krishnas and kind of various dodgy cults, right? And this was just another cult as far as they were concerned. But what they didn't understand was brainwashing actually is good, right? That is what they didn't understand. You're supposed to get brainwashed. The point is that if you're going to get brainwashed, you have to make sure you use the right soap powder, right? Otherwise, you don't come out clean on the other end. You have to have the right washing machine, a German washing machine. Actually, not Indian, Indian washing machine. Indian, are they good? Indian, well, I'm not so sure about that. Well, the Buddha. So the idea is, the point of that is, it's just, I'm just driving home the point that we are brainwashed regardless. That is the very thing which happens when there is no self, there is no stability inside. The nature of our minds is that we are brainwashed. We have no choice. And because we have no choice, we just have to choose the best brainwashing around. And that best brainwashing around is, as far as I'm concerned, and many others, is the Buddha's teachings. So this is what happens then, right? And then you get this brainwashing. Then you listen to the suttas. You reflect on them. You contemplate what they actually mean. You contemplate how they apply practically in your own life, right? All of these things are very important aspects of this. And then as you do that, something starts to change. Something starts to move. You find yourself getting more committed. You find yourself being able to persevere because you're getting regular input, regular feedback about what this path is really about. Right? This is what is at stake here. And so this is essentially how this commitment and perseverance comes about. Whenever you feel that, you know, you are losing the path a little bit, whenever you feel that you feel a little bit dispirited, whenever you feel that worldly conditions are becoming too strong, you're losing your sense of clarity, always go back to the teachings. Go back home, put on a nice Dhamma talk by Ajahn Brahm, right? Have a few laughs, hear a good stories, and while you do that, also you will imbibe the Dhamma, you get brainwashed at the same time. Brainwashing is much more effective if it can make you laugh at the same time, right? Much more powerful. So this is what you do. And in this way, by always remembering to go back to the source, right? Always return to the source. Return to where these things come from. If you do that, then that is where the commitment comes from. That is where your perseverance comes from. That is when this whole path starts to take off. So what is this path? I have to talk a little bit about what to do as well, otherwise I'm probably not doing my job. So just one minute. So what is this path? And one of the nice things about being a Buddhist monk or a Buddhist monastic and sometimes a Buddhist layperson is that sometimes you get access to people that are very special. Okay, number one is, of course, the Buddha. And don't underestimate, I should maybe talk a bit about this as well, because this is very important. Don't underestimate the power of having the Buddha as your teacher. Right? One of the things that sometimes when people read the suttas, they think it's all a bit abstract, it's a bit far away. The Buddha isn't really my teacher. He's a man who lived 2,500 years ago in a very different culture when everything was very different. But don't think about it like that. If you think about it like that, you will get alienated from the suttas, alienated from these very powerful discourses. How you should think about it is rather that when the Buddha gave these discourses 2,500 years ago, he knew that this Dhamma was going to be lasting for a very long time into the future. You could see how the wheel, this is the idea of the wheel of the Dhamma, setting it in motion, right? Rolling out into the world. The idea that this is a self-perpetuating process that keeps on going for a very long time in the future. So when the Buddha gave these teachings, he knew that there would be people sitting here at the BF on New Year's Eve, 31st December 2016. Okay, he didn't maybe know that, but he knew that there would be groups of people learning Dhamma even in the 21st century, right? Way, way into the future. And because he knew that these teachings would be so powerful, they would last for a very long time, they would spread into parts of the world very, very different from the culture of India at the time. Because he knew that, he phrased these teachings in a way that are very universal and are applicable basically across cultures, across times, wherever you go. And this is why, you know, you come here to Singapore, which is more like kind of a very modernized Chinese kind of society to a large extent, a lot of mixture perhaps. Or you go to Europe, you come to my country. I was born in Norway, for goodness sake. Oh, so, you know, talking about different from India, ice cold, just snow. We never even heard about Buddhism in those days. But as soon as you hear about it, whoa, this is the truth, right? This is reality here. And this is the power of these Buddhist teachings that are so applicable to anyone who hears them, regardless of culture, regardless of time. So remember that when you read those suttas, what you are reading things that the Buddha knew that people like us would be listening to these things 2,500 years later. He was thinking of you, right? Almost, not quite literally, but he was almost thinking of each one of us when he was giving those suttas 2,500 years ago. So read the suttas with that in mind. The Buddha is thinking about me when I'm reading this, right? He is my teacher right now. He is there. That intention was in his mind that I should be able to understand this when he gave these teachings. Once you look at it like that, it is almost as if the Buddha is transformed from a remote historical personality into your personal teacher right there and right then. Right? It's very powerful, and it kind of makes your hair stand on end, if you have hair, that is. But right? And you feel, whoa, this is just so good and so powerful and so beautiful. Because the Buddha is this extraordinary spiritual master, right, who existed 2,500 years ago. He is human just like us, but he has taken the human potential to the absolute maximum. And what a wonderful and amazing thing it is to be literally in the presence of a person like that. When you read the suttas, you are in the presence of this extraordinary human being who lived 2,500 years ago. So this is just one way of thinking about the Buddha. I think this is very important. If you're going to read the suttas, you have to do it with the right mindset, and then it becomes very powerful. But I was getting distracted, because what I really wanted to talk about was I wanted to talk about modern teachers, right? Sometimes you meet modern teachers that are very interesting and very different and very kind of powerful. And I just wanted to share one story that I had that was in Thailand earlier this year. You know, as a monk, you get to travel quite a lot these days. I'm not sure, maybe get to travel is probably the wrong way. You are forced to travel because you get invited everywhere. I come here, come there. Okay, so you travel around. It's often very, very nice to travel around because you always meet such inspiring, good-hearted, kind Buddhists everywhere. And if you, as a monk, you always get the benefit of people's kindness and generosity, always. So it's a very wonderful thing. Even in the West, people respect you as a monk. So anyway, so I went to Thailand. This was in April, I think, or something. And I went to a number of places. I went to one of the bhikkhuni monasteries in Chiang Mai, which was very interesting. I went to Bangkok to meet some of the people there. But also one of the things I did, I went to a very, very, very famous Thai meditation master who lives in the center of Thailand called Ajahn Gunha. Have you, anyone here heard of Ajahn Gunha? You have? Okay, great. Yeah. Have you been up and see him as well? Or, yes? Okay, so some of you have been up and see him. Okay, good. Okay, great. So, and this Ajahn Gunha, the reason I want to tell this is because just basically because of what he told me when I was there. He is very friendly with us at Bodhinyana Monastery because he's very close to Ajahn Brahma. So when I tell him, oh, I'm a disciple of Ajahn Brahma, oh, please, come in, right? He doesn't talk much to anyone, but if you are a disciple of Ajahn Brahma, he gives you lots of time. So if you want to speak to Ajahn Gunha, you've got to ordain first, and then you can go up there, say you're a disciple of Ajahn Brahma. That's the way to go. So I went to him. And when you get there, he's sitting on this big chair, right? So kind of almost a bit like a throne, sitting there. He's a small, very small monk, but he becomes kind of imposing because of this big chair. And he sits there, and he just has a very peaceful kind of smile on his face, right? Very, very relaxed. And he doesn't say very much. He just sits there smiling. And this smile and the peace that he has this magnetic effect on people. People just come traveling from all over the world, right? From Singapore, from Norway, from wherever. And they just come traveling there and they just sit down in his presence and they feel good and they feel relaxed and they feel at ease in the presence because the metta, the loving kindness, is so powerful. And it does all kinds of strange things, right? He has this long stick, maybe 2.5 meters long. And then he takes the stick and he pokes you on the head and he blesses you with his stick. Yeah. Right? So, okay, ding, 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 bless with the stick. Yeah. And then he has this bowl of sweets, right? The bowl of sweets, which is like massive bowl of sweets. And he has a little scoop. And he takes this scoop and he puts it into the bowl of sweets. And then he throws the sweets out on the whole audience. Right? So when you hear that, it sounds almost strange. It sounds almost kind of weird. Why is he doing that for? But actually, when you are there, it's very beautiful when you see it. It's a bit like having this rain of metta and sweetness of the sweet raining down on you as you sit there. And people are ready with bags, running to quickly grab all the sweets and take it back home. And whenever you have one of those sweets, it reminds you of Ajahn Gunha. It reminds you of kindness. It reminds you of metta. And that is why, how these things work and why they become so powerful. So this is a little bit about what he is like. He doesn't say anything much to those people. He just gives a bit of chant and does this kind of things. But I chatted with him for over 2 hours, I think. Yeah. Because again, you know, I was Ajahn Brahm's disciple. That's why. Simple as that. And I had only asked him a couple of questions. But the main question I asked him that was really important to me, because it's very obvious that he has so much kindness and metta, I asked him, how should one best practice metta in life? That was the one question I asked him. And he said, his reply was, and sometimes when you listen to this teacher, think, wow, he's going to say something really profound, right? He's going to say, you sit down in meditation, close your eyes, and you spread your mind out to the whole world, and everybody is included in your metta or something like that. That's kind of what you expect, just because of the way he comes across. But no, one of the wonderful things that you find about some of the greatest teachers, Dhamma teachers in the world, is that they are very down to earth. They are very practical. They give you teachings that you can actually use right here and right now, right? And to me, this is one of the almost the characteristics of somebody who is very profound, the simplicity, the directness, and the practicality of the teachings. It comes from the heart. It doesn't come from the head. Right? He doesn't say, oh, avijja paccaya sankhara, that kind of stuff. He doesn't say anything of that. He gives you very practical teachings. And how do you practice metta? And what he said that, when you wake up in the morning, you should ask yourself, what can I do today for the world around me? What can I do today for the people that cross my path? That's what you should ask yourself when you wake up in the morning, right? Oh, so simple. And I thought, is that all? Right, typical kind of, you know, clueless, don't understand the profundity of the teaching. You know, I didn't say anything because I thought it might be rude to ask for more, so I didn't ask for anything more. But afterwards I thought about it, I thought, yeah, this is the foundation of the Buddhist path, right? Kindness, having metta. Often we do metta, we sit down in our meditation, we say, may all beings be happy and well. Sometimes we don't feel anything, we just keep on parroting this thing away. It doesn't actually do anything to us. But when we do something practical, when you go out into the world and you see, how can I be kind to the people around me? That always works, right? Because you are kind. You are acting upon this. The meditation may not work, but the reality, when you start acting on these things, it always works. So I thought, actually, it's a very good point. And then, of course, if you keep on doing that, if you keep on always having metta to the people around you, it also has an effect on your mind. And after a while, your mind starts to change, because your mind starts to align with the way you act, because your actions almost force you to start to think differently about the people around you. Right? If there's somebody you don't like so much, right? You kind of almost have to force yourself a little bit to be kind to that person, because you feel a little bit, hard, right? But then you think, how can I think in such a way as to make it easier for me to be kind to this person I don't really like? And then you learn to focus on that person in a new way, to perceive them in such a way that actually you're able to be kind to them. You remember their good qualities. You remember to forgive them for their bad qualities, right? And then these things become possible. So I took that home and I thought about this and I realized that actually this is very much what the spiritual path is about. Not just waking up in the morning and asking these questions. If you have incredibly good mindfulness, that might be enough. But actually, from moment to moment, right? From day to day, from week to week, from year to year, using every opportunity you have to do something kind. Remember the incredible impact that we have on people around us. This is how you give rise to the compassion and the kindness in the first place. If you remember the impact you have on people around you. Right? Our mouth is one of those things that have incredible impact. We can say things that make people sad and depressed. Or we can say things that lift people up and make them happier. Right? We know that for ourselves, because we know if people talk to us in a bad way, it has a very powerful impact on us. If people talk in the right way, it lifts us up and we feel good about ourselves. And we have the same impact on the people around us. So remember that. Every time you open your mouth, right, there's a potential for supporting the people around you, for making them happy, for giving them a boost. Right? What a wonderful thing that is. There's the potential there for giving people a gift almost every moment of your life. Because we talk quite a lot. We have to do that to communicate. The potential is always there, right? Wow, take that potential. Don't forget, this is the foundation stone of the Buddhist path. It's all about doing, being virtuous, being kind, doing the good things. The potential, the possibilities are virtually endless, and because they're virtually endless, all we have to do is to sustain the practice, to commit ourselves and persevere in this. This is where the most important act of commitment and perseverance happens, in the goodness and the kindness in your ordinary life. Sometimes people think that it is enough to keep the five precepts. Right? And it's wonderful to keep the five precepts. I certainly don't want to underestimate this. If you look around the Buddhist world, the vast majority of Buddhists never keep the five precepts, right? I'm not sure if they should call themselves Buddhists sometimes. I don't know. They do, but they're not keeping the five precepts anyway. So, first of all, please keep the five precepts, right? This is such an important thing which advances you on the Buddhist path so fast if you start just doing that. So this is the basis. But then you start to realize after a while the five precepts become like a matter of course, right? For those of you who have kept the five precepts for many, many years, I know some of you quite well because you've been around for a long time. And so many of you have kept them for many, many years, for a long time already. There are many of you I don't know. I think it's the first time I see you. But or maybe I have seen you before. I just can't remember you. That's embarrassing, isn't it? But so after a while, it becomes almost part of your personality to keep the five precepts. It's like me as a monk. I've been a monk now for 21 years, right? And after a while, you don't really think about your precepts anymore. We're supposed to have all these precepts as a monk, but after a while, they become second nature. So you don't think about it. And when you don't think about it, the intention behind them is actually very weak. And when the intention is weak, the amount of good karma we make isn't that great anymore, right? It's through intention that karma is built up. So by not stopping at keeping the five precepts, but remembering that kindness is the entire foundation of the Buddhist path, it gives you the possibility of intending in every moment of the day, intending in a powerful way to be kind to the people around you. And sometimes it's hard, right? I'm sure that lay life is probably much more difficult than monastic life, much more business, right? Many more, you don't meet some nice people perhaps all the time, right? As you do as a monk and all these kind of things. So what that means, because it is more difficult, it means you have more opportunities to build up a powerful intention to do what is good. In the office, right? There's always some people in the office that you kind of don't find the most wonderful people in the world, right? Some are great, some are average, and some are maybe outright difficult. But if you find somebody difficult, it is a wonderful opportunity to train yourself in kindness on those people, because your intention has to be very strong if you're going to be kind to difficult people. You have to learn to think in new ways. You have to learn to see the good qualities in them. You have to learn to forgive them for the weaknesses. And all of that becomes part and parcel of this movement towards kindness in your life. So this, to me, is what Buddhism, if you're going to say Buddhism in a nutshell, what it's about, it's about that. It's about kindness. Right? I just, in Bangkok today, before we left, the last thing I told them was a very famous verse in the Dhammapada called the Uvada Patimokkha. This is an exhortation from the Buddha. And this is the verse you see everywhere all the time, that you to do good, or to avoid what is bad, to do good and to purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas, right? And if you look at those three factors there, it's all about kindness. It's all about goodness. This is the core. This is the foundation. This is the basis upon which everything else is built in Buddhism. So if there's one thing you should do, it is to commit yourself to kindness in your life. Meditation is secondary. Sometimes people put meditation first. Meditation should be secondary to kindness. Kindness is what is going to give real results in your life straight away. Meditation is only going to work if you have a good foundation of kindness. Then it will take off. And then you are on the right track if you do it that way. So this is then how we do commit ourselves, how we persevere. Go back to the basics. Understand the teachings. The more you understand these teachings, I guarantee you, the more confidence and faith you're going to have, because they are very powerful. If you don't gain more confidence and faith when you understand the teachings better, that's also okay, because sometimes we're not ready for them, and that's fine. But for most of you, I can almost guarantee you will gain more confidence, more faith, and you will start to understand why this is so powerful, why it is so incredibly useful, and that commitment will come as a matter of course when you do that. This is how I try to live my life, and it may be easier as a monk, but if you can do the same, then you will be on the right track. So now there is about 2 hours left to mid of this year. So now is the time to make your New Year's resolutions, right? Or decide on them anyway, and you can make them after midnight or whatever. Now is your chance. So if there's one New Year's resolution that I would recommend you to make, very simple, to be more kind in the next year, right? To remember how that kindness arises through listening to the Dhamma regularly and getting that inspiration on a regular basis. So if you remember that much, that one thing, wow, then you are going to be a blessing for yourself. You're going to be a blessing for the Buddhist fellowship, right? All your friends here are going to be so happy with you, and you're going to be a blessing for the whole world eventually. And isn't that a wonderful thing? We need more blessings in this world. So if you can be a blessing for the world, then it's such a marvelous and beautiful thing. Then you sit down in meditation, you think, wow, I'm a blessing for the world. That's pretty cool, isn't it? Be a blessing for the world. And then you feel so glad and so happy about yourself because you're doing that. And everything flows from that in a very beautiful way. So, I think I've talked enough. I'm getting a bit exhausted, so I'm gonna stop there. That's 1 hour of talking or something like that. I had no idea how long this was going to go on for, but there you are. So, if you'd like, I'm happy to take some questions as well, because I will be going back to Perth tomorrow, and I can chill for a few days when I get back, so that's good. So, is that what we do here? Yeah?
Yeah. So thank you, Ajahn Brahmali, for the valuable and very practical teachings. I think it's a wonderful opportunity to start the year well for all of us. So can we put our palms together and say sadhu loudly 3 times? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So on behalf of the congregation, may I request that maybe we take another 10 minutes to ask some questions?
Okay.
Okay.
One over here. Okay.
Sometimes when we are kind, right, people are taking advantage of our kindness.
Yeah, yeah.
How could we handle those people
taking
advantage?
Sure. So, if people take advantage of your kindness, right? So the thing is that the most important kind of kindness is your internal kind of kindness to other people that you feel good about. And this is the most important thing here. How you think about people is really the crucial aspect, right? But if people do take advantage of your kindness, then you just withdraw a little bit. You hold back a little bit. You don't allow that to go on. You don't put yourself in harm's way here. If you put yourself in harm's way, it is going to make being kind very difficult in the future, because you associate negative things with being kind. That destroys the whole thing here. So then just withdraw a little bit and be kind in a different way. Be kind to other people. But remember, most of kindness is not about, it's about simple things, right? Like not saying bad things to people, just saying, saying something pleasant to them, or good morning, something like this, good morning. If it comes from a good intention, it's something positive, right? Very simple. And that kind of stuff. It's usually the very, very simple things that this is about. And those things, I think, the vast majority of people will accept without actually taking advantage from you. So you have to feel it out. But I completely agree with you. If people take too much advantage and they start feeling bad about it, then it can backfire in a bad way. So that is certainly a good point. So find that nice balance somewhere here.
One more question? They're taking out their cameras.
Oh, okay. Much more important to ask questions than to take out cameras, right? This is your chance. This is your opportunity. So,
I suppose if I don't recall wrongly, Ajahn Brahmali, you were with us here like 2-3 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's probably right.
We don't know when we might have you back with us.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe people are just so happy with the talk. You know, that's really nice as well. There's one over there.
One over here.
Yeah.
So, Ajahn Brahmali, you mentioned about the importance of studying the suttas.
Yeah.
And I recently learned from a retreat from Ajahn Brahm mentioning that you're working on coming up with a new translation with some adaptation. I was just wondering if you can share a little bit about that.
Sure, that's a very good point, actually. One of the most difficult barriers to read in the suttas that people often find them difficult to read, and they find kind of the language is kind of too elevated, that kind of stuff. And one of the reasons for that is because one of the main translators of the suttas, Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, he also has a PhD in philosophy, right? That kind of puts the language, you have your dictionary over here and you have the suttas over there, trying to kind of figure out what's going on there. That makes it difficult. So it's very true. And Ajahn Sujato, my colleague from Bodhidharma Monastery, he is actually now in the process of translating all the suttas from the Pali into English. And they will all go online. One of the things that he was saying is a very interesting point. He's saying all the other religions, right, Christianity, Islam, whatever it is, they all have their scriptures online. It's only the blooming Buddhists that haven't got those scriptures online. So he was saying we need to get it out there. And then it wasn't possible to get those things out that already existed. So he decided, okay, there's only one way, I've got to do it myself. And the thing with Ajahn Sujato is that he is a very, very clever person. he is very good with English, so his language skills are really good. So because of that, you can assume that when he says he's going to make a nice and simple translation, it's going to be exactly that. The majority of people who read the suttas in English these days are not people who have English as a first language, often English as a second language, right? Probably the vast majority in the world. And for that reason, it has to be language everybody can understand. So that is on this beautiful website called Sutta Central. And as it happens, I'm also doing some translation. I'm translating all the boring stuff. I'm translating the Vinaya Pitaka, which is the monastic rules, which actually I'm very happy to do that because it's important as well. That also will go up there. But anyway, it will all be very, once it gets up there, and when it will be very easily accessible, hopefully, easy to read, nice to kind of, much more accessible than the existing translations. So just keep your ears open, and I'm sure it will be kind of, you probably have big posters in here and the BF saying, Sutta Central, open, suttas ready to be read, right? And I'm sure you will invite Ajahn Sujata again, and I'm sure he'll be very happy to talk. He loves talking about this kind of stuff. He's a very good good speaker when it comes to these kind of things. I'm sure he'll be back here again. So that is suttas. Hooray! Suttas.
Ajahn Ravani, there's also a bonus question here.
Yeah.
I think it's very pertinent.
Pertinent one, okay.
Yeah, so we attended your retreat last in Singapore, but missed it this year. Do you know what's your schedule like for next year?
Okay. I think Angie was talking about having a retreat at in Serpentine around this time next year, so 1 year from now pretty much, but at Jhana Grove. That is what she was taught. It's still early days. I'm sure it will be advertised, right? If there's going to be a retreat, it will be advertised. So keep your eyes open, and then hopefully, you know, it shouldn't be any problem. But I also do another Sutta retreat every year at Jhana Grove, which I do for the Buddhist Society of WA. But it's actually quite hard to get onto this retreat because the demand is quite high, right? People love the suttas. I find it so inspiring myself when large numbers come to listen to the suttas and try to understand these things. It's such a wonderful thing. So I get actually very inspired when I do these kind of things. So it's great. So just keep your eyes open. A bit uncertain yet, but it will happen for sure at some stage. Unless you die in the meantime, or I die, or something like that, which, of course, these things happen, right? Okay. Yes? Okay. I think it's great. I'll repeat the question because I think I understood it. The question is that in Bhutan is the highest position on the happiness index in the world, and one of the things they do in Bhutan is contemplate death. So you are saying, well, what's going on there? How come they get so happy when they contemplate death? It's a bit weird, isn't it? You make you miserable to contemplate death. But the point is that it's about how you contemplate death, right? It's not about whether you contemplate it or not. But if you contemplate death in the right way, it definitely makes you happy. Because what it does, it kind of takes away all of the silliness, the stupidity about thinking about the future, having angry thoughts, and all of these kind of things. Because if you're going to die, and you could die any moment, what happens if you could die at any moment? It means that the future becomes irrelevant. You're not going to desire stuff anymore. You're not going to think about the things of this world. So you let go of all of that, and a certain amount of mindfulness arises as a consequence of the death contemplation. So death contemplation done wisely leads to mindfulness. That mindfulness leads to you remembering what is important in the world, to be kind, right? So death contemplation had all of these effects. If you do all of these things in the right way, but it has to be the right way. If it gets you depressed, it's not very useful. But if you do it the right way, it can be very, very powerful. Okay.
Ajahn, is it okay?
One behind you. Okay, sure.
Thank you, Ajahn. May I check with you, could you give us some examples of kindness, being kind to people, acts of kindness?
Acts of kindness, okay. Well, you know, when you are sitting with somebody, you should ask yourself, what can I say in this moment that is kind to this person, right? It could be something like, you know, when I go driving with one of the Anagarikas in the monastery, I would say to them things like, wow, you know, you're driving really well, right? What wonderful driving here, getting me safe to my destination, no crashes, right? So, no, I'm kind of being a bit silly now, but the point is, there's always, when you see somebody do some work, or you see, there's always something you can say right there then, which actually is kind about what they're doing there, right? Or you can say to somebody, wow, it's really nice to have you as a colleague. I really, really appreciate your colleagueship. You're a really kind of cool character with an even temper. Right? I really, really appreciate that. Appreciate your presence as a colleague. And that goes straight to the heart of people. If you say to somebody, I appreciate you for your person, like wow, people really take that on board. And they really appreciate that. I can promise you. Simple things, right? If you are at work and you bring a cup of tea to somebody, right? Somebody maybe don't even like them that much, but you do it because you want to create a better relationship with them. Right? Little things like that. Your parents, very, very important. I was just talking about the parents earlier today in Bangkok. Very important to treat your parents in a good way. This may sound hard. It all depends on our relationship with our parents. But just by developing the right perception about your parents, understanding what they have done for you, the love they have invested in you, right? But you have to kind of think about that to make it real, because it's not so obvious always, because our relationship with family is often so complex. There's so many sides to it. So you just have to kind of reflect on it in the right way, and then it actually becomes quite easy to be kind to your parents. Help them out, right? And this is so important, I mean, especially in Asian societies where the idea of filial piety is even more important than in the West. It's important in the West as well, but probably more important here. Of course, sometimes it can feel like a burden. But if it feels like a burden, there's not going to be any joy there and happiness coming from that. So you have to think about it in the right way. Actually, my parents have done all of these things for me. I wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the basic things my parents taught me when I was small. They taught me to eat right, how to get dressed in the morning, how to not cross the street when the bus was coming, right? It's quite important to learn that, right? Your parents, this bus is bigger than you, so stay put. Basic things like that, right? And also the love. Sometimes we forget how difficult we were to our parents, right? We have been difficult as well. But they always have that love for you, always that forgiveness, always coming back. It may not be obvious because often they don't say that, but in the background it's always there. So the relationship with your parents is so important because we can make lots of good karma in that relationship. It is one of the most powerful fields of karma there is. We can also make lots of bad karma if we do it in the wrong way. So that is another tip for you on how to do what is right. So take every opportunity. Even more powerful is also to remember that metta is also in the mind. So you take every opportunity to think kind thoughts, right? Every thought you have is kind. Whoa, that's going to be pretty powerful. Right? So you ask yourself, when you have a negative thought about somebody, I say, okay, don't judge yourself. Don't think you're bad. Everybody has bad thoughts every now and again. No judgment. But ask yourself, how can I look at this person a different way? How can I have a kind thought about this person instead of a bad one? And when you ask that kind of questions, you are starting to turn your mind around and looking at things differently. You can see why this takes a lot of commitment, right? Because all of this takes a lot of investigation, understanding, commitment, trying yourself, energy, and all of these kind of things. And that's why I say commitment and perseverance are so important. It's the only way you're going to be able to do this kind of thing.
Ajahn Brahmali, out of great kindness, thank you so much for coming, rushing here from Changi Airport to, you know, spend this 1.5 hours with us. We wish you good health, happiness, and may you have a peaceful 2017. Can we put our palms together and say sadhu? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. One more request.
Yeah,
can you please lead us in the closing puja? Sharing merits as well as maybe blessings for the new year to come.
Okay.
Thank you.
What kind of puja do you normally do here? Is there any particular puja or just anything I fancy, anything I want to do?
I think anything you fancy.
Okay, great. Well, that's really easy then. Okay, no worries. Okay, so we'll just... Sorry? 10 minutes. Okay. 10 minutes first, and then do the puja afterwards. Quick one. Just like Arahang or something like that. Okay. So we'll just do this is the traditional Sri Lankan way of sharing merit. So we'll just do this together. Put your hands together, and then share it with all beings passed away, especially family members, right, who are might be in a difficult situation. Share with all of these beings. Idang men yati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Idang men yati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Idang men yati nang hotu sukita hontu nyatayo. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so to finish off, let's pay the homage to the Triple Gem and let's do the Arahang Sama Sambuddha together. Yes? Blessings. I have just given you 1.5 hours of blessings. Anyway, I wish you all a happy new year. May you all practice in a right and a good way. And hopefully, I will see you again sometime. Maybe we'll come back here and see what happens next time. And if you have behaved well, then it will be very nice to see you again next time when I come. Okay. So, anyway, so let's do the Arahang Sama Sambuddha together.
Brothers and sisters, kindly remain in Anjali. Let's pay respects to Ajahn with 3 bows. First bow. Second bow. Third bow. So Ajahn Barmali, wishing you a safe flight back to Perth, and we hope to see you in 2017.
Very good. Okay. Bye-bye, everyone.
You home too.